Welcome to The Last Alchemist. I'm William Leonard Picard. It's my pleasure today to converse with a dear friend of many years standing, Hamilton Morris. We're going to have a lot of fun. First, we'll have a few serious questions, and then things will get a little wild. You can find this on Patreon at The Last Alchemist for early viewing. Then it's released publicly and sponsored by JLS.Fund in New York City, a venture fund in neuromedicine. Well, good morning, Hamilton.
Good to talk to you, Leonard.
Yes, lovely to see you. We both met recently in Alaska at the Arctic Visions Conference, and we're both on stage, and I think, we danced with others at the gatherings and had a wonderful time. Saw whales and orcas and eagles all in one afternoon. Do you recall all that good stuff?
It was beautiful being in Alaska. I'm still eating blueberry jam from wild Alaskan blueberries and salmon that people gave me that was delicious.
Oh, yes. Cans of salmon everywhere. If you've never been to Alaska, it's an absolute must. The mountains are craggy and sharp and gone forever and ever. You have to have pontoons to fly in, 90% unexplored. But to today's podcast, first questions are prosaic that you've been asked previously, but let's see what we can do with these. So, Hamilton, what inspired you to start the Pharmacopoeia? What was your vision for that series?
My vision was a feeling that there was a dramatic disconnect between my experience with psychedelics and my understanding of psychoactive drugs and the way that they were typically depicted in the media. It felt like most people that I knew who had used psychedelics really enjoyed them and had benefited from using them. And when I looked at the way that these topics were covered in the news, it was always incredibly negative and always seemed aligned with the interests of law enforcement and always seemed to treat people being arrested for drug crimes as if it was just part of the natural order of things that shouldn't be opposed. And this disconnect was kind of maddening to me. It was so maddening that I think I felt the way many people do, which is that there must be some reason. People must be forced to write this way. It couldn't just naturally emerge that everyone is saying negative things about drugs in their reporting, but when you talk to them in person, they only say positive things about drugs. What is the source of this disconnect? And I would almost think that it was some kind of conspiracy, but the reality is that there was no conspiracy. A lot of this was self-censorship, self-imposed choices made by journalists who felt that this was the appropriate way to discuss these subjects. And the nice thing about it being a product of self-censorship and a sort of self-imposed decision by many writers was that it meant that people could talk about these things a different way if they wanted to. They could at least try.
So the vision for the series was to present drugs in a different light, to show more of the anthropology, the cultural differences, different insights. That was a very brave path for you to do. You lived through much of your life in the years of great oppression. And to go out into public with your series and talk about drugs in a non-biased but also not horribly non-negative way was an act of great courage, Hamilton, and I must applaud you for that. For our listeners, Hamilton and I have known each other for, 20 years. We first got in contact when he was an undergraduate, as I recall, Hamilton.
That's right.
So of the series, though, let's have some fun here.
Okay.
What's the most challenging or surprising moment you faced during the filming of those years?
There were many challenges. one that comes to mind that I don't talk about too often was there's a lot of ethical questions that go into making the sort of work that I was making, where people would often interview me and they'd say, weren't you afraid to be with this or that person? Weren't you afraid to be in this or that place? And the answer is almost never. I very rarely was afraid of the people that I was with, but I was often afraid for them. And I was very afraid that by talking to me or being a part of something that I was making, that they could be harmed in some way. That was what frightened me. And so even when people would come to me and say, hey, I'm making MDMA, do you want to come to my lab and film me making MDMA? It wasn't frightening for me to be in that lab. Maybe I had some concerns about whether there was adequate ventilation and I was inhaling too much DCM or something like that. But realistically, the personal safety concerns that I had were minimal. The real concern was, what if that person got into trouble as a result of inviting me into their lab? And that really scared me. And so I remember there was somebody who was incredibly, and I'm really telling this story because this person is tragically passed, so I can be a little more open about the story than I otherwise might be. But this person was very, very proud of having learned to synthesize MDMA. They had done every element of the synthesis self-taught. They'd even synthesized the mercury chloride that they were using to make the aluminum amalgam for the reductive amination. And they'd done all of this and taught themselves everything. And they were incredibly proud and they were doing a good job. I actually saw analysis of the MDMA that they were synthesizing and it was very pure. And they wanted me to film it. But they were so open, I believe in part because they were using the MDMA themselves, which possibly clouded their judgment about what was safe and what wasn't safe. And I was very afraid for them that they wouldn't stop making MDMA, because I made it clear to them that I would film what they were doing, but that they would be putting themselves in increased danger and that they should probably stop what they were doing after the piece came out.
Well, I can contribute to that. Generally, underground chemists, although they should stop perhaps at some point for safety, generally are so infused with the spirit, they see no end to it. They see the world as a benign place when there is the reality of serious arrests and penalties. The fellow that invited you into his laboratory, that's quite an amazing story. I spend most of my life avoiding photographs, that sort of thing. The idea of having a film crew in a laboratory would be completely unthinkable. But at the same time, perhaps he was later in his life and wanted to show people how things were in such a laboratory, and therefore was doing a public service, but the potential cost of his life and those of his friends. But thank you for sharing that.
Yes, and nothing did happen. He was okay in the end, but he had mental health struggles and eventually took his own life. And it was a very bittersweet thing that after he died, I was able to show his mother the video of him doing this chemistry, and she really loved seeing it.
Perhaps she had a greater understanding of the nature of her son and why he did what he did. Perhaps it was helpful to her after his passing.
Yeah, I think it was.
In terms of the future of psychedelic research, what do you find most exciting?
Well, I'm a lover of the unknown, and I get excited whenever I hear that anyone is doing anything unusual because of the possibility that something totally new will be discovered. I'm always delighted to hear about targeted work in various domains. Somebody's looking at inflammation or glaucoma or neurodegenerative disease. That's always very exciting. But what I've always loved is the chance that you will discover something that you didn't even know that you were looking for, something completely, completely unanticipated. And And that, I think, is one of the main things that I learned from reading Sasha's work is, you know, there's so many gems in that work. For example, there's a compound desoxymescaline that has a methyl group in the four position instead of a methoxy group. Well, one of the things that he notes about desoxymescaline is that it's sweet, that the compound itself is sweet. Who would have ever thought that exchanging a methoxy group with a methyl group would create a compound that has a sweet flavor? And that's actually not the only phenethylamine that is sweet.
I hope the experience was as sweet as the taste. Let me give the audience a little insight into how bizarre Hamilton's chemical explorations can be. Correct me if I'm wrong. Hamilton recently went to Spain to synthesize a psychedelic that incorporated tellurium, in which there are absolutely no psychoactive compounds with tellurium in it. There's always the opportunity for the fortuitous discovery.
And that's kind of the idea. I was been working with another friend of yours, Jika Nykodymova, Czech chemist. And that's part of the joy, is what kinds of strange things might we find along the way that we would have never anticipated. So many of these things, whether it's triboluminescent effect of DMT or the blue fluorescence of LSD or these different things that would be very difficult to predict, but when you observe them, it's really magical. And, you know, I've had so many of these little observations that to this day I have no idea whether they represent something that's truly useful, but it's fascinating to see all that can come out of these structures.
Hamilton, for our audience here, is speaking in terms of LSD, the luminescence, piezo fluorescence, which is caused by mechanical agitation of crystals. It's seen in a wide variety of crystalline lattices, not only LSD, but many things. If you take a gram of LSD, pure crystal, and send us out a closet for a moment, your eyes adapt, then pitch black, you shake the vial, sparkles, purple sparkles everywhere like stars. It's quite beautiful. Few people, of course, have seen that, but I'm glad we could share it with the audience.
I've never seen it. I've always wanted to see it.
Oh, it's quite beautiful. And as well, if you, for example, have a Buchner funnel containing, say, 100 grams of needles of LSD, and you scrape the edge of the Buchner funnel with a spatula, it will light up quite purple. Very, very beautiful. The same with the chromatographic column as you're separating the LSD from iso-LSD. The principal forward column is a beautiful blue fluorescence, all while the lab is bathed in red light to prevent damage to the molecules. Jitka, which Hamilton just spoke of, was Hamilton's colleague during his graduate studies in Pennsylvania. And Jitka had above one of the fume hoods, I think, a picture of Sasha and Anne Shulgin for inspiring her. She was quite devoted to their memory. Do you recall that, Hamilton?
Oh, yes. Yeah. She had a picture of Anne and Sasha. Also, of course, was delighted to work beneath a picture of them. I put up a picture of Primo Levi, who's kind of, in addition to Sasha, the other chemistry inspiration, not so much for his actual synthesis, but I thought that his writing about chemistry is very beautiful and inspirational.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
How do you see the future of psychedelics and medicine therapy, say over the next 10 years? Where are things going to go? What's the stage in 10 years? Who's doing what?
I would hope that things calm down a little bit, because I think that's one of the unfortunate aspects of the excitement surrounding psychedelics. It's great because it promotes investment in psychedelic companies, it's great for researchers, but when everything is under the microscope and is being scrutinized, then it creates a intensity that is hard to sustain, where if there's only a 3-point reduction on the Hamilton depression rating scale as opposed to a 4 or 5 point, then everybody thinks it's some kind of disaster, as opposed to saying, hey, wow, this is pretty much as good as the standard of care. This is pretty much as good as anything that we've got. This is very impressive, right? If somebody had come up with a new SSRI with the same efficacy as psilocybin, I think most people wouldn't even really find it remotely objectionable. They'd be excited about it. But because the hopes are so high with psychedelics, and because they, I think many people think that they represent a revolution in psychiatry, anything less than perfection turns into a big news story. And so I hope that people can retain their enthusiasm and retain this momentum while also having slightly more restrained expectations about how all these things work, because for all of their many potential benefits, there will be many road bumps ahead. There will be people who have psychotic episodes and people who feel that the treatments didn't benefit them in some way. And what I really hope is a culture that is, to have a culture that's mature enough to recognize when bad things happen and when people aren't helped, but still move forward with the understanding that the benefits should continuously be explored, and having a balanced understanding of both the harms and the benefits of these things. It's very hard for our culture to do that. It's either harmful or beneficial, but what you really want is a balanced recognition of the capacity to both help and harm, so that people can move forward in a mature way.
Hamilton, the positive aspects that we're seeing, however, are the advent of big pharma, major pharma, for example, AbbVie, for example, recently acquiring Gilgamesh for $1.2 billion, and not their entire portfolio, not their non-hallucinogenic hallucinogens, but actually a modestly psychoactive psilocybin analog. Do you see big pharma following the AbbVie profile and coming into the space?
I think they will, if the clinical trial results remain as impressive as they have been. You know, I'm not someone that thinks nobody should take SSRIs or that SSRIs are terrible, but the reality is that they do cause pretty severe sexual dysfunction in the majority of people that use them, and that few people are delighted by SSRIs. And I think that having a psychedelic antidepressant is probably going to be a very good option for some people, probably not for everyone. But I think that if it turns out that the 5-fluoro-MET compound that AbbVie bought from Gilgamesh for $1.2 billion, continues to show the same results in clinical trials and is well tolerated after its approval, then I see no reason that big pharma wouldn't continue to show interest in this space. I mean, that's the way these things tend to work.
It is a watershed moment. You know, SSRIs, as you note, are anhedonic. They kill desire. That would make me depressed, and then one might need another drug to counteract the effect of that drug. Yes, not only anhedonia, but long-term use can lead to tardive dyskinesia, type of serpentine movements in the elderly, and not really treatable, sort of irreversible. But they're great promise, of course, for these things. Well, you're addressing this question already, but let's give it a try. What do you see as the most common misperceptions these days about psychedelics?
I think what worries me is when people start attacking each other, thinking that medicalization is bad. That's, I think, a common one where they say, you know, Big Pharma is going to come in and they're going to ruin everything. And I'm not saying that that's impossible, but it simply isn't reflective of anything that I have observed. And I'm not exactly sure even what that would mean. So this is what worries me, is it's not that I think people shouldn't have concerns. The concerns are valid, but it worries me if people forget about prohibition, if they forget about the very real legal obstacles that exist for the study and medical use of these compounds in favor of concern that a pharmaceutical company might make money off of them. And it's a kind of funny reversal of the major talking point that I would hear when I was growing up. When I was a child in the 90s and people would talk about psychedelics, they would say, oh, well, the reason that they're illegal is because Big Pharma can't make money off of them, because they can't be patented, and they can't, and because they cure people as opposed to act as a treatment that has to be taken daily, they make them illegal so that nobody can cure their diseases, right? But now that Big Pharma is actually investing in this stuff and people are patenting it and it's being developed, then suddenly people think that's a bad thing. So it's funny to see in my lifetime how these two opposing sides of this argument have come into the discussion.
Speaking of opposing sides, you actually wandered into DEA headquarters recently for the DIPT-DOB hearing. Tell us about the entryway and all the fun you had as you approached that fearsome den of lions.
Yes. Well, I think a lot of people listening to this, probably, I certainly wondered about what really goes into these decisions and who's making them. If a drug becomes illegal, who decides? What's the mechanism? Who stamps this and says, yeah, it's illegal now? Who are the scientists that participate in this decision-making process? Are there any scientists at all? Do you hear from opposing voices, right? These are fundamental questions that I didn't really have a good answer to. And so being at DEA headquarters and actually seeing how this decision-making process is conducted was deeply illuminating and frankly somewhat horrifying, because they do have a series of items, factors that they are examining to decide whether or not a drug has abuse potential. But the way that they define these things is only superficially reasonable. There's a facade of reason, but as soon as you penetrate that even slightly, you realize that the arguments are not built on a sound foundation of science, and that many of the experts who are speaking at these hearings are being ignored, that the very idea of expertise as it's construed in these legal environments is bizarre and alien to most people. And it is, it's discouraging, but it's also important to see these things for what they are, because if you don't know, if you haven't seen it, then it's harder to figure out how do we build a case so that we can be sure that scientists are able to study these things and people are able to use them medically and people aren't going to prison for having whatever sorts of relationships with them they want to have. And, you know, one of the things that I realized is that they really do like the politics of respectability. All this stuff that Rick Doblin, for example, does of, you know, getting researchers at prominent universities involved in research, it's published in scientific journals to study use of these compounds to treat diseases. All of this is, I believe, the appropriate tactic based on what I
have appropriate
seen.
Tactic, but yeah. The problem with you, as you point out, and the hearing, you get the feeling, as in certain courts, that the decision is already made by the people that have the signatory power. and that the entire episode is simply a show for the public of going through the motions, but the decision's already been made in the back room. And then experts, certain favorite experts, are brought in to support that decision, make it look very plausible in the public eye. So I think your view of that matter is entirely correct. Anything interesting happening out front in the lobby, or anyone being arrested? Or...
I mean, well, they have a museum.
They've got her lying down.
they have one very interesting thing is that they have a DEA magazine, there is a article in the magazine in the waiting room where you can read about the arrest of a certain prominent person who has been alleged to be involved in some lysergamide synthesis. And I sent you a photo of this article, and you had a very funny response that I won't share. But
thank you, Hamilton, for your discretion in mentioning said individual. So let's move toward the fun stuff. Let's see. So how do you balance the scientific and the sensational in your work?
It's a little bit tricky because I do think that science is very beautiful and fascinating, but I'm also aware of the reality that it's pretty boring for a lot of people. And so this is one of the things that I think is wonderful about drugs, is that I think that as a pedagogical tool, they are amazing for getting people interested in science. It's a funny thing that they have been treated as this terrible thing for scientists to be interested in, especially if you're a young chemistry student, to be interested in making drugs, how terrible. But it is a wonderful way of getting people interested in
that. Not just chemistry, but throughout medicine, psychiatry.
Yeah. Of course, yes, yeah. Because you have to be interested. You know, if you say to somebody, hey, you should learn about a Diels-Alder reaction, they're going to say, why? And if you say, it's good for learning about frontier molecular orbital theory, they're going to say, who cares?
Molecular orbitals.
But then if you say, well, hey, you know, it's actually pretty fascinating. You know, this same reaction was used to create some of the most powerful opioids ever discovered, and super powerful psychedelics and stimulants. And
now it's interesting suddenly.
Yeah. Suddenly this.
That's kind of like Sasha when he would lecture. I attended many of his lectures at Cal and San Francisco State. And when Sasha knew that the undergraduates tended to really hate organic chemistry because the molecular structures on the board were kind of these fearsome, complex hexagons with tails and this sort of thing hanging off of them. And studying organic was so hard. So before he put up a molecular structure on the board, and this was chalkboards and chalk in those days, he said, I'm going to draw some dirty pictures. Of course, all the male undergraduates set up immediately and woke up and paid attention to draw the molecule. So there are ways of making it stimulating. So quickly, what are you up to these days? What are your projects you're working on right now? And what's coming in the next couple of years for Hamilton?
Yes. Well, I'm working on a few different documentary projects. One is a short piece about the synthesis of Ariadne, another short piece about chemistry at Sasha's lab, a short but longer piece about lysergamide synthesis, and another piece about the introduction of synthetic compounds into mushroom substrates, and a big piece about tellurium chemistry. There's a lot of, and perhaps most importantly, I'm hoping to do a piece about your research and your life as well. I've edited something together, but this is something.
From the audience, Hamilton, I've been negotiating this situation since 2006. And of course, he's done about 8 hours of interviews at a lovely ranch of a friend in northern New Mexico. And so we're almost there, folks. And so Hamilton will have his wicked way. There's something a lot more expansive than this interview, but it's greatly satisfying to have the first bite at the apple, Hamilton, by having you being interviewed on this podcast. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Let's see, the fun stuff. So if you could have dinner with any historical figure and talk about psychedelics, who would it be? Or three or four?
Yeah. I mean, there's different people. Obviously, somebody, you know, like Gordon Alice would be interesting because
Gordon Ellis, folks. That was Sasha. Everybody has a hero. When I was growing up, Sasha was my hero. Then I asked Sasha once, "What is your hero?" Oh, Gordon Ellis. Gordon Ellis in the 20s was the inventor of Benzedrine, the early phenethylamines, this sort of thing. And when Gordon died, his reports and all of his scientific literature were kept in a garage in L.A. And Sasha was, until his dying day, was very eager to acquire those. He wanted to read them and publish them. And so Sasha's hero was Gordon, as Hamilton will expand upon.
Do you know what happened to these documents?
Let's see. It was the famous psychiatrist, Oscar Janiger, I think, in his garage in L.A. I think the wife inherited it when Oscar passed away. What do you have to feed on that?
I didn't know that they were kept by someone. I've always wondered about that because there's so many aspects of this history that just disappear entirely. And that's what always worries me, is all the work that's been done where all the context, all the information surrounding it just disappears. Like another example would be the French chemist Marc Julia, who did a really some amazing tryptamine and ergoline chemistry in the 60s, made 5-methoxy-4-hydroxy-DMT, and also, I believe, made a sort of minimized LSD structure where the sort of pyrrole region of the indole ring had been removed, if I remember correctly. So he'd done a lot of very strange things. And I remember I reached out to one of his graduate students and said, you know, I've noticed that Marc Julia was doing this work with these psychedelic type compounds. Why was he doing this? What was his interest? And they said, I don't know. Never talked to them about it. Sorry.
The love of the science, you know, let's do one more odd thing to the LSD molecule and hopefully it will be psychoactive or better. But I think we're stuck with a parent compound for another several decades. In terms of Oscar's wife might still be alive, so we might be able to locate Gordon Alley's records. Let's make a little agreement to try to find those, shall we?
Yes, let's do that.
Give them let's to do or Harvard, we'll figure it out. So what's the most bizarre or unexpected reaction you've had from someone after sharing your work? That could be film, could be a sample of Aleph, could be anything.
The most bizarre reaction. I mean, a common reaction is that, you know, people say, oh, I would love to be a guinea pig. And then as soon as you probe that a tiny bit, of course, it wouldn't be ethical to just, you know, but I'll sometimes just for the sake of argument, I'll probe it and say, really, you'd like to try a completely toxicologically unknown compound? And they say, oh, it's unknown. Well, is it safe? And I'll say, I don't know. Nobody knows if it's safe. And they'll say, well, what does it do? And I'll say, I don't know. Nobody knows what it does.
Don't know yet. There's been no human ever tried it.
And then you realize very quickly that the sorts of people that are eager to volunteer to be a guinea pig, in fact, have absolutely no interest whatsoever in trying genuinely experimental compounds.
So they have a basic sanity.
Yes.
They were guinea pigs to begin with. They sobered up really quickly. You know, Sasha was that way. He would synthesize a molecule, and there it was. No human had ever tried it. And so before he subjected his friends to it or suggested they might try it, he always tried it himself. He thought that was the medicinal chemist requirement, especially in psychoactive compounds. So Sasha would try a very tiny amount, kind of the Hoffman approach to LSD, a little more until he noticed the threshold dose. And if he liked it, then he would ask his friends to check it out to verify his conclusions. But, you know, he was putting his head in a world that no person had ever gone. And that could be full of surprises. It could be extraordinarily difficult. It could be a challenge to one's health or even lethal. Or it could be a miraculous new medicine. And Sasha was the courageous person that went there.
Yes, he really was courageous. And the reason that I think that's a very important point worth emphasizing is when these people make this comment about, I want to be a guinea pig, right? What they're really saying is, I want to try LSD, or I want to take an LSD type drug. And the reality is, when you actually endeavor to try experimental compounds that are toxicologically uncharacterized, a huge amount of care and caution and bravery and education is required to do it with any semblance of safety. And so if people talk about Sasha as if, you know, what trying drugs was, you know, easy or a lot of fun, I'm sure occasionally it was a lot of fun, but the reality is that it was serious scientific work that really was tremendously valuable. And I think it's sometimes hard for people to appreciate that element of it because they see the fun reports in P-Call and T-Call, and you forget about the concern and the fear and all of the emotional, intellectual intensity associated with being the first human being to try something like 2CP or any of these compounds.
Well, Sasha was put himself in a position, of course, it was a very sobering moment to do that first compound. He had to be the one to warn us if it were a dark space of great horror. But he could also sound the trumpet that something wonderful and beautiful is happening.
Yeah.
So what a position to be in. I think 9 or 19 out of 20 of his compounds were some sort of psychedelic murkiness that no consequence, not worth reporting. And he spared his friends and the world from those compounds. So what a man. What a man.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the funniest, most unusual place that you've ever conducted an interview or experiment, excluding Sasha's lab? What's the funniest or most unusual place you've ever...
Yes, that's
anyone or
that is a good one. Let me think for a moment because there have been some strange ones, certainly.
Oh, well, we can pick a few.
Yes, I mean,
Bangalore, the tellurium in Spain.
Yes, I mean, the one that was particularly weird would be filming in these synthetic cannabinoid labs in China was very difficult because, understandably, the proprietors of these labs had reservations about allowing me to film. They had no reason to trust that I wouldn't do something that would harm their business in some way. And so they completely objected to that. And my idea to work around this was to film with this man who, Matt Bowden, who was a very prominent figure in the cannabinoid industry in New Zealand, because he had financed so many of these labs with his cannabinoid products. I thought that they would be inclined to trust him. And even though he had a very strong relationship with many of these labs, they still said, I'm sorry, you can't film here. And then I had the idea of asking if we could film in the labs, not as a documentary, but as a sort of location to film a music video. And that was surprisingly fine with them. So we filmed
the covert operation. You wandered in and with a elaborate deception, and they
went. No, interestingly, there was no deception. We did film a music video in these cannabinoid labs, and so there was no deception at all. We did all of this filming it entirely openly, which was what I wanted to do. I didn't want to deceive people.
What was the music? And what was the music?
How was the music? It was good.
What was it? Do you recall?
It was a kind of glam rock kind of
glam rock.
Yeah, kind of thing.
Go.
But that was in an unusual place to do interviews. It was in the music video rock opera inside the Chinese cannabinoid labs. So that was a weird one.
Say, Hamilton, clear something up for me. I recall mentioning some years ago that, Sasha gave me one of the first samples of 2CB in 1988 and asked for a report on it. And then it went on to become sort of an international rave drug. And then I heard that there was a Sasha cult or 2CB cult of 30,000 or so tribesmen in Africa. And we were in Africa. Did you check that out? Was it real or not?
Yes. Yes. So I became totally fascinated by that story. And there's some documents about it on Arrowhead, if you look. And the documents often quote a South African anthropologist named Manton Hurst, who is a real anthropologist who's employed by a museum in King Williamstown, South Africa. And so I traveled to this part of South Africa to meet with Manton Hurst and hear the story firsthand. And the story was very different. It was actually that there was a legal loophole in South Africa where if you could establish that a drug was associated with traditional use, in this instance, it was traditional use among Xhosa people, that it could be sold with reduced legal hindrance of one kind or another. And so they had hired this anthropologist to effectively fabricate a history of traditional use in order to serve as a way of protecting their sale of 2CB. And they were pretending that 2CB was a natural product. I think they were calling it brominated caffeine.
Their
odd term for it. Obviously, it is not a cathinone or a beta hydroxy compound.
What a bizarre reach. Thank you for debunking that particular myth. So no cult of dancing tribesmen with Sasha as some sort of Haile Selassie type deity.
But one could imagine such a thing. And I think there was even it's been years since I've read it. I believe there's a section in P-Call or T-Call about a group that was sort of worshiping some elixir made from MDMA. Do you remember this story?
Yes, he traveled into South America. He was with a very affluent set somewhere in which he was wined and dined and taken around pool parties with these gorgeous people standing around. And then after all of that fetting, he was taken down to a subterranean laboratory where he was asked to demonstrate the manufacture of MDMA. They regarded it very highly and Sasha very highly, but he felt he was unable to do so at that moment. So you've gone on record. You've gone on record talking about the Defense Department's use of astrology for nation. I see you as a scientist at heart. Instinct. So this really surprises me. I only learned of it today. Could you expand on your interest in astrology and where that came from and what you're doing with it and how does the Defense Department work into this? And I hope the audience has stayed with us to get to.
Yes, I'm very interested in astrology, but not as a way of predicting the future or human affairs as mediated by planetary alignments, but as a tool for manipulating people, which I think is a role that it has played throughout human history. That's not to say that there's anything necessarily wrong with people enjoying astrology. It's, in the same way that alchemy is a foundational discipline that led to chemistry, obviously astrology is what led to astronomy in many ways. So I don't wish to entirely disparage it, but I was interested in the idea that astrology could be used as a tool for the dissemination of targeted disinformation. And there was a CIA whistleblower named Miles Copeland who wrote a little bit about this idea that the CIA was distributing compromised astrology computers to manipulate foreign heads of state. Now, this is an idea that cannot really be corroborated. I haven't seen it referenced in many texts. So the extent to which this occurred is unclear to me, but I find the idea very provocative.
Yes, Miles was a defrocked former CIA agent, I think, that did quite a tome on the Afghan covert ops, that sort of thing. How unusual he would do that. How did your interest in astrology blossom? Where did this come from?
Yes, I mean, it's mostly because I've had a long-term obsession with Marcia Moore, author of the first popular book about ketamine, Journeys into the Bright World.
Oh, yes.
And so she was an astrologer. She wrote a very widely read textbook on astrology and wrote her thesis on astrology at Harvard. She was a really kind of astrology obsessed scholarly writer on the topic, and was also, I think, someone who is an early proponent of political astroanalysis and using astrology to guide the decisions of politicians, which I think feeds naturally into this more conspiratorial interpretation of astrology later.
Do you think Marcia's worldview evolved from her ketamine use? Ketamine use evolved from her worldview. And how does that relate to you?
Well, I mean, I've thought a lot about what effect ketamine had on her. And I think that there's a frustration that exists among spiritual teachers. Maybe they're teaching meditation, maybe they're teaching yoga, maybe they're teaching some kind of spiritual discipline, and they feel a frustration with the difficulty of introducing ideas to people that don't get it or struggle to use the techniques that they are teaching. And I think this was one of the really important selling points for ketamine for Marcia Moore, was the idea that maybe this could be a tool that would allow other spiritual ideas to be more organically introduced into people's consciousness. Maybe a normal person can't do past life regression therapy, but with ketamine they could. And
agreed. And with sufficient ketamine, their life would pass.
Well, in this instance,
50 in ketamine, certainly in that. Thank you, Marcia, for your contribution.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, Hamilton, if you were you had to pick a psychedelic compound to describe your personality, what would it be?
That's an interesting one. I mean,
we'll skip Salvinorin A here.
Yes, yes. I mean, I do. It's so hard to say because my impression of various compounds is, of course, colored by my personality interfacing with that particular molecule. So I do feel that Ibogaine has a certain rationality to it in my experience that felt beneficial to me. I liked this sort of dispassionate feeling of looking at myself with some semblance of an objective appraisal of who I am and why I am the way that I am. And there was something about that that I thought was really wonderful. And I know that you often talk about, you know, the power of the sober mind and the natural mind, and how this is sort of the ultimate experience, is making peace with the gift of consciousness and finding balance within what you naturally have, and not endlessly chasing and augmenting and diminishing and accentuating, but to find balance and peace within yourself. And it is maybe strange to say that you can or it seems wrong to say that there's are drugs that can help you achieve that, but I do think that Ibogaine in particular is something that really made me feel at peace with myself and better able to appreciate the natural state of things.
Right. And if that peace continues after the drug experience wears off, then that's a lovely place to land. That's the benefit of psychedelics, I think, is they're self-attenuating. It may be a difficult experience or a harsh experience, but you land on your feet and stay there for the rest of your life. Not such a bad place to be if you're comfortable. Thank you for bringing that out, Hamilton. Yes. So imagine you're a time traveler and you could go to any era for a psychedelic experience. Where would you most like to trip?
I would probably go to an era before humans, if I could. I would probably go way, way back. I would probably be in a more Jurassic, Triassic type domain, if only for the ability to see these things that otherwise could never, ever, ever be seen. As amazing as it would be to explore so many different eras of human history, I would probably prefer to look at types of life that I otherwise could never see.
Well, I would enjoy those yard-long dragonfly wings, but what about those pesky reptiles?
Yes, right. That could be bad. That could be, or maybe they would be, friendlier than anticipated.
Okay. Okay. Great. I'm glad you asked that. That brings up the next question. What's the most memorable reaction you've gotten from a pet after experimenting with a different substance? You come down, you see a pet, surely you've been there.
Yes. Yes, I have. I mean, dogs are already so expressive and have such vibrant personalities, but I think psychedelics can really accentuate the personality characteristics of a dog. I mean, I remember being around my parents' dog while I was on farm ayahuasca and just being so blown away by how beautiful and seal-like the dog was, that I was, I was praising the dog so much that I could tell that it was sort of alarmed by my behavior.
Right.
And it was kind of giving me a very suspicious look of like knew that there was something up, that the praise was too effusive. But
your parents must be extraordinary people to see Hamilton go through all these changes growing up, especially with your DIPT episode, playing mellow music and listening to off half tones and what have you.
They've been good, yes.
Okay, in terms of that, tap tones, if you had to choose a theme song for Hamilton's life, what would it be?
A theme song.
Arts Cello Concerto Number 3, Purple Rain.
Purple Rain. I mean, I do like Purple Rain. I'm a big admirer of a musician who's from Massachusetts named Jonathan Richman, who played in a band in the 60s called The Modern Lovers and continues performing to this day. He's, I think, a wonderful person who is actually a sort of vaguely anti-drug character, but I would say anti-drug in a way that is sort of aligned with your own philosophy. Anti-drug only insofar as he wished to promote an appreciation of the natural mind and a understanding that suffering is part of the human condition. And he has a couple songs, two versions of a song called When We Refuse to Suffer that I really like, about how when you refuse to suffer, it only promotes suffering. It's a sort of uplifting pro-suffering song that I really enjoy.
I'll trust that's not too atonal, but thank you for the background music to Hamilton's life and experience as you do the arc of your emotional journey. Goodness, If you were a character in a sci-fi movie, may well be, what's your name? And who are you? What would be your special ability? Transmutation of elements into psychoactive materials at your fingertips?
I mean, most of the science fiction that I read feels like some dystopian commentary on the world that we currently occupy. And I suppose the abilities would be some variation of the same things that I currently value, which are being able to create unusual types of matter and I guess a good story would usually seems to involve some kind of nefarious thing happening, which I'm not personally all that interested in doing, but this seems to be the case with a lot of these stories. Although even the best sci-fi stories, I think, sometimes have a sort of realistic relationship with the world. Like, I think that A Scanner Darkly by Philip K. Dick is a really powerful book, in part because it ultimately represents a somewhat accurate reflection of the effects that drugs have on people, even though it's done with a lot of dazzling strangeness and suits where people's faces morph and all this sort of thing. I think that ultimately it's a grounded commentary on the effects of drugs.
Well, Philip spending a lot of time in West Marin running amok, so he certainly invited these experiences in the early 60s.
Did you ever cross paths with any of those characters, the Philip K. Dick type people?
Well, many. Yes, yeah. Many, but that's for your interview of me one day.
Okay.
What's the most outlandish myth you've heard about psychedelics that you've wished to debunk or simply heard?
Most outlandish myth.
Levitation, ESP, the God experience, changing street lights from red to green. The radio is playing your song. What's the most outrageous myth you've heard?
I mean, there are very outrageous things that I'm not so worried about. The popular one at the moment that you may have encountered is this idea that if you shine a laser beam through a glass of water while smoking DMT, that the reflected beam contains a sort of matrix code of our simulated reality. This has become a popular enough idea that I think there's even a documentary being made about it at the moment. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is somewhat harmless. I'm not really on
Also fascinating, the idea of seeing elves transmitting a code, a key opening the crack in the universe even wider.
Yes.
The rumor was, the myth was, if you played I Am the Walrus at a very slow speed, you would have a phone number appear. And if you call that phone number, a long black limousine would pick you up and take you away. Quite a few people were like, spent hours and nights playing I Am the Walrus very slowly or backwards, I think, on 33 and a third recordings. And trying to call the phone number. So yes, well, be careful, folks. Don't do this at home. Okay, last question, Hamilton, although we could talk for hours, of course. What's the most bizarre piece of trivia you know that most people would find surprising? What secret do you have that is not yet public that might be enjoyable to hear?
Oh, there's so many tantalizing little fragments of information that aren't widely understood. I mean, even I think I mentioned to you, at least in passing, I've recently learned quite a bit about the history of Ariadne. And there had been an ongoing mystery about why the clinical evaluation of Ariadne was discontinued when the phase two clinical trial results were so promising. And I have recently learned that this mystery, at least as it had been framed in the past, is not entirely a mystery. There are known reasons that the clinical evaluation was discontinued, having to do with research fraud that was in no way connected to Sasha Shulgin.
That's right. That's a very elaborate and lengthy story about a very strange deception among researchers. Perhaps has something to do with Ariadne's tendency, as Sasha recorded, for ego inflation. He liked the drug, but he was worried about that and recorded in his journals. A closing anecdote. I'm sitting with Sasha and Anne, oh goodness, before they wrote Pikal in the early 80s, in the moonlit night, the moon falling down to the ground, and there's Sasha's silver hair and Anne's silver hair. And he's opening his great journals with hundreds of compounds back for decades and the structures and all that, and his notes. I'm flipping through the pages going, where's the one that says Eureka? He's found it. And the one he pointed to was Ariadne. But he did worry about problems with the ego. A closing story for our audience. And folks, this is a historical interview to have Hamilton aboard. So let's listen to a final Hamilton story. And what would you like to share with the audience today, Hamilton? Or advisory or...
Well, I would say that I think that you've done a wonderful thing in being diplomatic and kind to people. And when I look to these people that I really admire in the psychedelic world, Sasha Shulgin, Anne Shulgin, Rick Doblin, yourself, what I often see is that they're very calm. They try to bring people together. They try not to divide people. And I can say from personal experience that I love to see that and admire it, because this is not my tendency. It's very easy to see something as a threat and say, oh, well, it's my responsibility to address this threat. But then this becomes a cycle. It becomes a war. Everybody starts attacking each other. People are divided. And what's really valuable is people that can promote a calm, connected, reasonable community, and for people to work together, because so much good comes out of that and so much harm comes from division, that I really admire seeing someone like you, where I can tell everybody who's in the audience really wants to hear what you have to say. They feel connected to it and they're grateful for you being there to share the stories you can share. So I think that you represent something that is very good for the psychedelic community, and I think it's worthy of recognizing, and people should strive to be as diplomatic and kind as they can possibly be.
Thank you, Hamilton. I see you in return as the voice of a new generation. You hold the keys to the future. You are a seminal figure, and what you say counts. And the fact that you said, let us not be divided, I have to concur with. You know, when this whole thing started, at least in the Western world around LSD, beyond the indigenous in the 60s, there were only a few hundred thousand, a few million of us. But one of the defining characteristics of the experience was a sense of community, of strong community, of lowering of barriers. People were accepting. It was a coming together. We had enough problems with oppressive laws not to fight among ourselves. So perhaps that's both of us can leave that lesson for the audience today. As the Beatles put it, come together. Let's come together. We've got enough problems outside ourselves, and make peace and walk in the light together. And thank you, Hamilton, for coming aboard today. I'm delighted I got to interview you first. I hope the audience had an enjoyable tour Hamilton and I do this all the time. One last story. When Hamilton and I first met in New York City, physically some years ago, we started walking to a gathering. We got so involved in talking that we walked 30 blocks from 40th Street to 70th Street before we realized we were going the wrong way. Turned around and walked another 30 blocks the wrong way. Turned around a second time, third time, and then finally arrived at destination. And my feet hurt for days. What a conversation, and continued for years, and may it continue for some more years. But to our audience, thank you for visiting. I hope you found this rewarding and fun. And thank you, Hamilton, for your kindness and coming on The Last Alchemist and telling us of your life and work.
Of course, thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure. And I encourage the listeners to encourage you, Leonard, to let's get a film made about some of your work, because I think it would be a wonderful thing for a lot of people listening to this.
Well, thank you, Hamilton. We'll see you in the attorney's offices. Take care.